supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
In Pennsylvania, the number of people dying from drug-related overdoses rose nearly 40% last year. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Those figures are coming from a report from the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. Details from WHYY's Katie Colinari.
The DEA found that last year, more than 4,600 Pennsylvanians died from drug overdoses. That's about 13 people a day.
It's not a distressing number. It's a stunning number.
Jeremiah Daly heads up the Philadelphia-Camden high-intensity drug trafficking area. That group helps coordinate anti-drug policing in the region. Daly says in his 37 years in law enforcement, he's never seen statistics this bad.
This is not a new problem for us, but by God, this is the worst it has ever been.
And the data show the synthetic opioid fentanyl is why. More than half of overdose deaths last year involved fentanyl, which is cheaper and more potent than heroin. DEA Special Agent Gary Tuggle says it used to be that drug suppliers were mixing it with heroin.
Now drug dealers are just selling fentanyl, and the users know they're getting fentanyl, right? That's very, very dangerous.
Tuggle says the drug is mainly coming from China and Mexico, and the feds are investigating dealers and drug rings that are selling it on the hidden, encrypted corners of the internet known as the dark web. Law enforcement officials say going after the sources of the drugs is one part of the approach. They're also using this new data from the DEA to work with public health agencies, for example, on ways to get more of the overdose-reversing medication naloxone into the hands of first responders. Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro says, armed with this information, the goal is to lower the overdose death rate this year.
This report helps us do our job.
Katie Colinari, WHYY News.
After beaches up and down the New Jersey coast were closed this week due to high levels of bacteria, the state announced late this afternoon that they are open and will be for the coming weekend. Joining me now to talk about what happened and why the beaches were closed is NewsWorks Down the Shore blogger Justin Osiello. Justin, welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight.
Hi, Dave. Thanks again for having me.
Now, Justin, it looks like rain, which is still in the forecast, is the culprit. Why?
Yeah, Dave, we've had rain in recent days, and for anyone that lives in the Jersey Shore, rain obviously doesn't just make it for a bad beach day, but it also creates the concern of either swimming advisories at our beaches or beach closures. It's actually a pretty simple reason why. When we have heavy rain, the water needs to go somewhere, and the water is going to drain into the bays or the rivers or the ocean. When that happens, the runoff is bringing all types of matter, and when we're talking about advisories or closures, we're talking about fecal matter from animals. The state of New Jersey has a standard they test for. If the sample exceeds, they'll either issue an advisory, a swimming advisory, which means that you can swim, but it's really at your own risk, or there's a closure. At that point, the beaches are still open, but you can't go in the water. It's not a new thing, but it is certainly a concern after rain. And if I can add, Dave, we are looking at some heavy rain beginning tonight through Saturday. So potentially, even if Sunday's a nice day, there could be some problems at our beaches.
So we're talking about bacterial concentration from animal waste, clearly not from toxins like syringes or other man-made medical detritus.
No, we're talking about animal waste, and this is waste that can cause bacterial conditions in humans. The other problem is, Dave, is that it's not just the heavy rain. When it coincides with onshore winds, meaning the wind is blowing east towards the coast, that tends to create problems as well, because that keeps this water from being pushed out to sea. So it is something to be aware of. If you're a beachgoer, you should always check njbeaches.org, and that is updated with the current list of advisories and closures.
Do these situations typically remedy themselves in hours, days, or could it be weeks of closures?
It all depends. Some areas, have some impediments, some physical impediments, which keeps them from draining as quickly as others. So, some beaches can clear up within a day. Others, it may take 2 days, sometimes 3 days. It really all depends on a variety of factors, but in my experience in reporting in the Jersey Shore and for being a lifelong resident of the Jersey Shore, I've never heard of beaches being closed for weeks at a time. This tends to clear up on its own. Wind shift, we have, you know, a series of nice days, and it tends to, Mother Nature just does us a favor and allows us to go back into clean waters. And I can add, Dave, is that the state tests water quality at 35 bay beaches and 180 ocean locations. So the vast majority of beaches that most people are attending are being tested.
How frequently are they being tested?
They test on Tuesdays. The samples are then brought back to a lab. And then that information is either released late on Tuesday or early Wednesday for the next day. And then if there is a closure or an advisory, that will be relayed to the public through njbeaches.org. Now, leading up to a closure, if a sample exceeds the threshold by a substantial amount, they'll test for two consecutive days. If that remains the same, then they will close the beach. And then at that point, they'll be testing on the day or days afterwards as well until they get to the point where they're going to be comfortable reopening the beach.
Thanks, Justin.
Thank you, Dave.
NewsWorks Down the Shore blogger Justin Osiello on NewsWorks Tonight. More than half of all mushrooms grown in the United States come from Pennsylvania, primarily Chester County. But finding enough people to pick them has been difficult in recent months. That's according to Megan Klotzbach with Mother Earth Organic Mushrooms.
We are not able to harvest all of the mushrooms that we are growing.
Around half of all agricultural workers in the country are unauthorized immigrants. But mushroom growers are barred from using guest work programs to hire legal immigrant workers. With several bills in or headed to Congress, WHYY's Laura Benshoff reports that that may now change over the objections of immigrants' rights advocates.
Last week, U.S. Congressman Dan Newhouse from Washington State stuck a rider on a Department of Homeland Security spending bill. While only one sentence long, the addition is a boon to year-round agricultural industries such as mushroom and dairy farmers. Existing law bars them from applying for workers through a seasonal visa program called H-2A.
The rider to the appropriations bill says that H-2A workers could be approved to perform agricultural work without regard to whether such work is of a temporary or seasonal nature.
Bruce Goldstein is the president of immigrant advocacy group Farmworker Justice. He says making agricultural visas year-round contradicts the reason for creating the program in the first place.
The H-2A program is premised on the idea that seasonal jobs don't yield enough annual income to attract many U.S. workers.
Criticism of the expansion is twofold. Some say it could poach year-round jobs from American residents, while others point out the potential to abuse foreign workers who are tied to a single employer. While that spending bill is still winding its way through the House, Republican Representative Rob Goodlatte from Virginia announced plans to introduce his own legislation to overhaul the program. No matter the package, Pennsylvania mushroom growers like Megan Klotzbach say they're hopeful relief is on the way.
There's some positive things going on out there, and people are really pushing to get these things through. So that's a good step in the right direction, and I'm very happy.
Productivity in Chester County's mushroom industry was down 2% last year, and some growers blame the lack of labor for the slump. Laura Benshoff, WHYY News.
The major party candidates vying to replace New Jersey Governor Chris Christie have in turn disclosed their lieutenant governor selections. A little over 3 months until Election Day, let's get perspective from PolitiFact's NJ editor and publisher Nick Acacella. Nick, welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight.
And thank you, sir.
So what's the strategy behind, well, why don't we start with the Democrats, a Murphy-Oliver ticket?
Yeah, it's interesting because the two strategies are entirely different. The Murphy strategy is to pick a seasoned legislator, somebody who has been the Speaker of the State Assembly, somebody who has been very, very forthright in expressing her own opinions over the years, and has a relationship with a lot of people in the legislature.
It's the yin and yang with Murphy, who has not held elected office.
Exactly. And on the other side, the Republicans, you've got somebody who is completely, almost completely new to politics. think he's been mayor of a small town in Bergen County for just a couple of years. And the strategy there is there's no baggage to attack. There's no way to do a negative ad on somebody who has no track record. So they're two different strategies, and we'll see how they work.
Carlos Rendo is not a household name.
No.
What do you think had Guadagno chosen somebody with more name recognition, Joe Piscopo?
I think for her sake, she wants to get as far away from the known as possible. Because the known in the Republican Party means the governor, and she wants to run away from his record. Joe Piscopo, an interesting idea, but it was never going to happen. I mean, he was never going to run. He was never going to be her running mate. It was a massive ego trip.
Is it in part that New Jerseyans are still getting comfortable with the notion of a lieutenant governor?
Oh, indeed. I think if you ask most people, they wouldn't even know there's such a thing as a lieutenant governor, and with good reason. I mean, the lieutenant governor is the most, how can I put this politely, the most useless job ever conceived by the mind of man. I mean, the job has no responsibilities, no salary attached to it, no staff attached to it. Unless you make this person a member of the cabinet in some other position, the sole responsibility would be to call the governor every morning and make sure he or she is alive.
Now, that job description was enacted in part based on Chris Christie's whim, though. Could Murphy or Guadagno change the parameters of the responsibilities?
No, it's constitutional. No, it's constitutional. It had nothing to do with Chris Christie. They wrote it this way. The way it stands now is in most states, the lieutenant governor presides over the state Senate. Well, no Senate president who was the presiding officer here was ever going to allow that to happen. So they wrote a completely functionless position just because they wanted to spare the state the idea of the Senate president also being acting governor, which happened when McGreevy resigned. That was the only reason for it. No, it's written into the Constitution. No salary. No official functions, and no staff.
Well, perhaps like it's launched Guadagno's career, she's running for governor. Perhaps there'll be a Rendo for governor in 8 years.
That is the one temptation to take this job. That is the one temptation to run for lieutenant governor. It gives you a statewide presence that you couldn't otherwise possibly get. I mean, Guadagno was snatched from total obscurity, the sheriff of Monmouth County. I mean, How many people in Monmouth County could name the sheriff? So that's the one reason to do it.
That Guadagno is down by double digits in the polls and way behind in money.
Way behind in money, name recognition, and in the polls.
Is this all but a fait accompli, in your opinion?
Nothing's ever a fait accompli. We all thought that with Donald Trump. I've given up predicting because they only remember when you're wrong.
Thanks, Nick.
Thank you. Thank you, David. See you. Bye-bye.
PolitiFacts, New Jersey editor and publisher Nick Acacella. Last month, the School District of Philadelphia ended its contract with a private school for emotionally disturbed students. This seemingly innocuous decision set off a debate over how to educate some of the city's most vulnerable kids. Special education advocates say the students should be reintegrated into public schools. Some parents aren't so sure. What follows is a story about integration and segregation. But in this case, as WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt learned, those who've been segregated are the ones trying to keep it that way.
13 has been a hellish year for Kayla Hinton. In November, a man shot and killed one of her closest friends just steps from her home in Kensington. In May, her father died of a heart attack. And in the months between, she's battled suicidal thoughts.
It's been pretty depressing. I've been having to go in and out of hospitals. It's just been crazy.
Though the last year has been especially devastating, Kayla is no stranger to setbacks. She suffers from ADHD and a mood disorder called DMDD. In school, she struggles to focus and follow directions, and when she was younger, she would spring out of her seat spontaneously and walk around the class.
I felt like I was a weird person, like, because nobody else would do that. I'd be the only one getting up, so I felt like depressed because people would look at me some type of way, like I was like a creature or something.
Since moving to Philadelphia in 2013, Kayla has been in three different schools. Each one was supposed to be a better fit for students like her, students who need what's known as emotional support. So far, says her mother, Catherine Artuso, the district's programs simply haven't worked.
I just feel as though, in my opinion, that my daughter would be way better off in an approved private school just because of the simple fact the school district has let me down multiple times already.
This isn't a unique request. When the district can't serve a special needs student, it pays for that student to attend a specialized private school. There are about 1,500 cases of this in Philly, but that number could start to drop. The district is creating new in-house programs for students with extreme needs. They're like private schools inside public ones. Earlier this month, the district started a new program for emotional support students like Kayla. And it did so because of major problems at one of these private providers, Wordsworth Academy.
Philadelphia police are investigating the death last night of a 17-year-old male resident of the Wordsworth Academy.
In October, a child at one of the nonprofit's residential treatment facilities in Philadelphia died after a scuffle with a staff member. In late June, Wordsworth filed for bankruptcy. That same month, the School District of Philadelphia said it would no longer send children to a day school run by the organization in Fort Washington, Pennsylvania. For many, it was a common-sense move, but not for Francesca Castelli.
Just for me to think that he don't gonna be in this school anymore, this is, I don't know, just thinking that my son can be in a bad situation, this is really putting me out of control.
Castelli's son, James, is one of about 100 Philadelphia students who attended the Wordsworth Day School in Fort Washington. The school is primarily for students with emotional disturbance. James has autism and a chromosomal disorder called microdeletion. He rarely speaks and is prone to outbursts.
My son can don't talk. My son cannot tell me who's hurting him, who is doing something wrong to him. This is like my main concern, and this is like the most stress that I carry in my life.
Advocates and officials want to bring high-needs students like James back into the district, for their own good, they say. But some parents, like Castelli, can't stand the thought.
No public school anymore. He needs to be in a private school that they know to handle my son need, you know, that they know to work with, you know. It's not easy to work with my son.
Lots of kids who end up in private placements like Wordsworth struggled in regular classroom settings, and the idea of giving public school another shot scares their families.
The worst case scenario would be he would be put into a regular school.
That's Harriet Glassy. Her grandson, Charles Kane, started at Wordsworth 2 years ago, and she says he has blossomed there.
And if he's put in a regular school, he's going to start up again with the fights and the arguments, and he's not going to learn anything. He's going to graduate school knowing nothing. Nothing at all.
Now, district officials have good reasons for trying to reintegrate students like James, Kayla, and Charles. There's years of research showing special ed students do better when they're mixed into regular classrooms. And in light of that, some special education advocates say the district's plan to create new in-house programs doesn't go far enough.
Inclusion does not mean a separate setting within the school district.
This is Maura McInerney of the Education Law Center at a recent School Reform Commission hearing.
It means placing students with disabilities in general education classes, but incorporating fundamental changes in the way school communities support students.
McInerney and others say special ed students shouldn't just be placed in district-run schools for special needs. They should be placed in neighborhood schools and given the support needed to thrive there. But other experts warn the concept of inclusion or integration doesn't work in every case. Plus, a lot of parents, like Harriet Glassy, swear by the seclusion model. They're deeply skeptical of a public system they believe has failed them.
It's not going to work. Not for him. Not for my grandson. He needs the one-on-one, and he needs the smaller classrooms. Because if you put him in a big classroom, he's just one of the kids, and he gets lost.
The school district here is caught in the middle. It's got to balance the calls of advocates with the wishes of parents who prefer sheltered private schools. And sometimes that preference is remarkably strong. Castelli has already started to develop a contingency plan back in her native Dominican Republic if James can't stay at a school like Wordsworth.
I'm going to send him back to my country that my family take care of him. Because I'm trying to protect my son.
Talk about integration all you want. but Castelli says she knows what works for James. Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
A once iconic restaurant brand is back. No, you can't eat there, but you can sit and sip its offerings in your kitchen. WHYY Shai Vanyakov reports on the iconic Horn and Hardart chain's transition to a coffee company.
Horn and Hardart was so popular in the mid-20th century that it was frequented by celebrities like Cary Grant and Marilyn Monroe and featured in movies like 1937's Easy Living.
I'll put the nickels in when I get paid and you can pay me back sometime.
I'm not that hungry.
Don't be a sucker, sister. That beef pie is a wow.
And you may not know that it was actually the name of the two-headed monster on Sesame Street. But for Al Mazzone, growing up in Atlantic City, it was pretty much the only place where the whole family could eat.
We had so many relatives in Philadelphia, New York, and when I was really a young kid, whenever we went to visit relatives, I think the only restaurant we ever went to was an Automat. Because especially in New York, it was a very large family, and no one in New York had an apartment big enough to have 15, 20 people for dinner.
The stores first opened in Philadelphia in 1888 as Quick Stop Luncheonettes. Then in 1902, Horn and Hardart introduced the aforementioned Automat, a glistening wall of tiny coin-operated glass doors containing prepared food a la carte. Just drop in the coin, open the door, and take out your tapioca pudding, baked potato, or ham sandwich. It was heaven for a kid like Mazzone with a restless disposition.
I didn't like having to sit down at a table, having, you know, a waitress come over and having someone else, my aunts or my mother, order for me and tell me what I had to eat.
Instead, his relatives sent him to the Automat with instructions and a pocket full of change.
So the first thing I would do is I'd go up and I'd get a slice of pumpkin pie. And then while I was going down getting the cream spinach and everything else, I would eat this entire slice of pumpkin pie.
Mazzone's nostalgia for the chain, shuttered now for nearly 30 years, prompted him to try to revive it somehow. An initial attempt at keeping the restaurant open in the early 90s fell flat, so he looked to a part of the business that those of a certain age still remember, coffee.
Horn and Hardart, when they first opened up the first location on Chestnut Street, 13th and Chestnut, they were really known for their coffee. It was a small lunch counter, but they sold a lot of coffee. They were written up as having the best coffee anywhere that anybody had in this area, at least. So that was like, it felt like a natural, and it felt like a good place to start from.
Mazzone experimented with blends himself until he found something that approximated the old Horn and Hardart's drip coffee. Then he took on two other investors. One, Dan Levins, is a self-proclaimed coffee connoisseur.
I used to roast my own, so the coffee quality had to be there for us to jump in.
The company is now offering mail-order coffee and will begin selling K-cups next month. There's also a documentary about the company in the works, set to be released next year. While filming, Mazzone says the group stumbled upon a woman who's already become their most loyal customer.
We, by accident, met someone, and her aunt was one of the last waitresses at Horn and Hardart in New York. And Helen just turned 101. And the story is, if Helen doesn't have her Horn and Hardart coffee, you don't want to have to deal with Helen because she can get a little testy.
As for reviving the Automat business, Mazzone says he's not quite ready to open that door. I'm Shai Ben-Yakov, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.